Psalm 22 is where we will start today. We've been talking about the incarnation. We've been discussing how or why the incarnation was necessary. And last Lord's Day, we went through Athanasius' argument on why Jesus actually had to come as a human. In short, his argument, and it was a good biblical argument. His argument was basically this. God promised to Adam and Eve that if they were to eat from the garden, eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, that they would have to die. However, God made man to live eternally with him. So therefore, if Adam and Eve sin, then God's will would be thwarted, because God intended man to live with him eternally. Yet, God can't just change his mind and go, I was not serious about the whole death thing. And so, humanity must die because of sin. This is why Jesus had to come as a man, because if he did not come as a man, truly as a man, he could not die as a man, and therefore could not take mankind's punishment for them. Therefore, Jesus had to come ultimately as a man. And that was essentially the core of Athanasius' argument. And biblically, it is sound. And so today we're going to be focusing on that death, but we're going to be focusing today, and I expect next Lord's Day, on reading Psalm 22 as a Christian. Okay? Because it was written, as we know, quite a long time before Christianity, in the sense of followers of the man named, the God named, Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Psalm 22 was written way before that. But what I'm going to try to convince you of today, and we mentioned last time, is the New Testament clearly reads this psalm as not about David, as it says itself, but about the new David, about Christ. So let's start by reading Psalm 22. I'm going to point out a few verses as we go along, and then we're going to read some from the Gospel accounts and from Hebrews, and we're going to see where they show up. Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? All right? Many of you will probably remember this being quoted by Jesus in the Gospel accounts. Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. David is in a state of despair, right? He sings as if God has forsaken him. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted, they trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued, in you they trusted and were not put to shame. In his soul he feels rejected, in his mind he knows God's faithfulness. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. We'll see that come up again. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. We will see that. Yet you are he who took me from the womb, who made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. So there's a mixture of despair, understanding, and faith there. Many bulls encompass me, strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouths at me like a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death, For dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. We will see this in the Gospels. But you, O Lord, do not be far off. O you, my help, come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the mouth of the lion. You have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. Notice the shift. You have rescued me. We are now shifting to praise. I will tell of your name and name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him, all you offspring of Jacob. Glorify him and stand in awe of him, all you offspring of Israel. For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, and he has not hidden his face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. Oh, and by the way, verse 22 is quoted in Hebrews, as we mentioned last time. From you comes my praise in the great congregation. My vows I will perform before those who fear them. The afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. And all the families of the nations shall worship before you. For kingship belongs to the Lord. He rules over the nations. David has the belief that God is not just the God of Israel, but is actually supreme over all of the nations. And if God is so great, then surely he would be holding his kingship and rule over all. Did that happen during David's lifetime? No. He was king, but not the whole world. At least Israel was where his worship was focused. David has to wait for something else for this. All the prosperous of the earth eat and worship. Before him shall bow all who go down to the dust, even the one who could not keep himself alive, even the dead. Posterity shall serve him. It shall be told of the Lord to the coming generation. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. And so David finishes his song. It is obviously, the entirety of the psalm is written in this state of praise. Now, he went through something, we don't know what it is. He went through something that at one point, and this happened many times to David, as we know from his life, that put him in a state of despair. It was not uncommon for bad things to happen to David. Yet, when he writes the psalm, he writes it as a story, right? He writes it as a story. He starts off with these feelings of forsakenness. His mind knows that God rules over all, but he feels like God has abandoned him. But by the end, we see David, right, as he really was, a man after God's own heart, knowing that God will actually not forsake him, and not only not just forsake him, God will actually rule over all. God will win in the end, and David will be a part of that. That is ultimately the hope that David has by the time he gets to the psalm. The New Testament quotes the first verse, as we mentioned. It also quotes the stuff about the casting of the division of the clothing. You've got the book of Hebrews quoting the verse, I will tell of your name to my brothers, in the midst of your congregation I will praise you. The New Testament sees Jesus and Jesus' work throughout this whole psalm. Not every verse is quoted in the New Testament, but pretty much the whole thing is covered. And as far as Christian theology is concerned, all of this makes really good sense. And so let's look at the New Testament evidence, and then we'll come back to the psalm and read it as a whole as a Christian psalm. Let's start in Mark. Mark chapter 15. Might be helpful to keep a bookmark or a piece of paper back there in Psalm 22. Mark chapter 15, start with Mark only because he is likely the first gospel to be written, but who knows for sure. Chapter 15, you've got Jesus delivered to Pilate. Pilate delivers Jesus over to be crucified. He is mocked by the soldiers in verse 16. Verse 21 is where we'll begin reading. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Why do you think he would? That seems like an odd fact. The father of Alexander and Rufus? This is completely irrelevant. Why would he bring this up? Right, because it's not completely irrelevant. All right, whoever Mark is writing this to, at least some of them, they know these two guys. This was the father of these two people. You either know or you've heard about. Alexander, so the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, and he did not take it. And they crucified him, and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. Okay, so there is one quote there, or one reference. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him, they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads, as we saw in Psalm 22, and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And so mockery played a strong part in Psalm 22. We see that here again, though we don't here see the exact same statement that we saw in Psalm 22. We'll have to wait for Matthew for that. Verse 33. And the sixth hour had come. There was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And so at that point, Jesus now quotes the first verse of Psalm 22. Now, I want to point out one thing, since you have Psalm 22 still bookmarked, hopefully. Look at verse 16. "For dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and my feet, I can count all my bones. They have pierced my hands and my feet." Notice, I mean, that sounds like a description of crucifixion, right? It's not quoted in Mark. You actually will not find that quoted in any of the Gospels. And as far as I can tell, anywhere in the New Testament. That particular translation, I'll go and bring it up now because there's no good place to bring it up. That particular translation is very problematic. I'll read what the NET Bible has to say about it. As we've discussed before, translations have lots of sacred cows that people are, loath to sacrifice. This is one of those. NET Bible, does anybody happen to have their NET Bible with them? I know a few of you have one. NET Bible says, "Yes, wild dogs surround me, a gang of evil men crowd around me. Like a lion, they pin my hands and my feet." That's how they translate it. Not pierce, but pin, as if he is held down by a lion. Here's their note. In Hebrew, like a lion, my hands and my feet. This reading is often amended. Do you know what amended means? To amend something? Change it. This reading is often changed because it is grammatically awkward. But perhaps its awkwardness is by rhetorical design, its broken syntax. And this is the Net Bible note, once again. They geek out on syntax and language and stuff. Its broken syntax may be intended to convey the panic and terror felt by the psalmist. The psalm is a song. It is something to be recited. It is something perhaps to be performed. It's not dry, descriptive prose. The psalmist may envision a lion pinning the hands and feet of its victim to the ground with its paws, a scene depicted in ancient Near Eastern art, or a lion biting the hands and feet. The line has been traditionally translated, "They pierce my hands and feet," and then taken as a foreshadowing of the crucifixion of Christ. Though Jesus does not appropriate the language of this psalm while on the cross, the New Testament does not cite this verse in describing the death of Jesus. If one were to insist on the emendation, at the best you could maybe get maybe gore, as in a bull goring his hands or something. But their point is, this has a long pedigree of English translation, as of saying, "They pierce my hands and my feet." But what they're saying is, there's no good reason to take it that way, and we probably shouldn't. Well, it's one of my favorite things about the Net Bible. In a lot of places where, if you go and read commentaries and people looking at these texts, they'll go, "This shouldn't be translated this way," but it's always translated that way. Really shouldn't be. They will often point that out in notes, which is actually really helpful. Reality is, it doesn't need to say that. All right, the New Testament never quotes it as that. It's just a traditional rendering that has stayed around. Now, if it should say that, then it does fit quite well with the New Testament. If it doesn't actually say that, that's fine too, because what's the meaning of this verse? "He is surrounded by evildoers and beset around." Is that true of Jesus? Did that happen to him? Absolutely. All right. But the New Testament does not quote that verse, though it would, if it actually said that, it'd be a perfect verse to quote. They don't quote that verse, and they don't use that as a part of their argument. Back to Mark. Yes, sir.
Just to make that crystal clear, what he's saying is that there are certain translations that they know are not the best translation, but to deviate from the traditional way causes a lot of grief.
Yeah.
And we'll say, "You're trying to take out the crucifixion of Jesus." And y'all have seen some of that before, where translations are accused of changing verses around to be less reverent towards God or whatever. But yeah, Really just trying to be more accurate.
You're trying to destroy the doctrine of the Trinity by taking that verse out, is another good example of it. Yeah. And you don't want to paint everything as marketing and money, because it certainly isn't. All right? If you want people, if you are doing translation as a service to God, and I do assume most translators do, you want more people to read your translation. You want as many people to read it as possible, because that's the purpose of you doing it. If you do things like the Net Bible folks did here, all right, and as modern translations have done when taking out various verses that are suspect and should not be there based on the manuscripts, you run the risk of people saying exactly that. "Don't read that translation. They don't believe in the Trinity because they took these verses out. Don't read this translation because they don't believe that Jesus was crucified or wasn't predicted." It would be an argument somebody could make. And the Net Bible folks, I know a number of the translators. They're Orthodox. They believe what we do. It's not that at all. It's them going, "The text doesn't say that. We have to stick to our guns." So in Mark, so turn back if you're not there. You know, if you read the gospel accounts, it always says they crucified Jesus. They actually don't even focus on the nails. All right? That's something we focus a lot on and is right to focus on. It was very, very normal for the Romans to crucify their prisoners by nailing them to crosses. And so this is not controversial, but I just thought it was interesting as I was reading it. If you go to example the chapter 15, verse 24, and they crucified him and divided his garments. All right, this is what the Gospels say. They crucified him. They actually don't go into the details and focus on the actual nails at this point. This is something that we do, not something that they did. But they wouldn't need to. What does it mean to be crucified? Nail someone to a tree. All right, this is not details they needed. These are details that we have to fill in. That's what crucified means. Don't have to spell out the details. Now turn to Matthew chapter 27. So we saw three things there in Mark that reference Psalm 22. The garments, the wagging of the heads, all right, and mocking. All right, that general scene. And Jesus asking, why, my God, have you forsaken me? Matthew chapter 27, 35. Start with 32. They went out. They found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. And they compelled the man to carry his cross. Notice his sons are not mentioned here. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. And when they sat down and kept watch over him there, and over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God, but let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Note verse 43. "He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him." Psalm 22, verse 8, "He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him if he delights in him." So Matthew adds more details than Mark had at this point. So we see all the same things. There is the crucifixion. There is the giving out of the garments. There is the wagging of the heads and the general derision. And then specifically, the same scorn that you see in Psalm 22 is mentioned here in Matthew. Now turn to Luke. Luke 23, verse, we'll start at 26. "And they led him away. They seized one Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. And there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. But turning to them, Jesus said, 'But daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, Blessed are the barren and the womb and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? All a prophecy of soon to come judgment. Two others, who were criminals, were led away to be put to death with him. And they, when they came to the place, which is called the Skull, they were crucified. There they crucified him, and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they cast lots to divide his garments. Psalm 22. And the people stood by, watching, but the rulers scoffed at him, saying, they're scoffing again. He saved others, let him save himself. If he is the Christ of God, his chosen one. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, if you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. There was also an inscription over him, this is the King of the Jews. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. It was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. While the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two, then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Now, we didn't read from Matthew Jesus' quote of the very first verse of Psalm 22. I meant to, I just forgot. It's in Matthew 27:46, just a few verses beyond what we read. Luke does not quote it. But he does talk about the mocking. He does talk about the garments. And in place of a cry of abandonment, he has Jesus giving his soul, giving his spirit into the hands of God. Now turn to John 19. In terms of the details, remember, we're writing to different audiences. Mark felt the need to include the names of two us, random dudes, presumably to his audience, not necessarily random. Perhaps they knew them. Matthew, a lot of the same things, leaves out the two men's names, adds some details. Luke, a lot of the same things, leaves some things out, adds other things. The gospel writers are all writing for different audiences. This shouldn't concern us. This is actually very normal. If you've got different people writing the same account, some will include some pieces of information, some others. John chapter 19. Let's start in verse 16. So he delivered him over to be crucified. This would be Pilate. So they took Jesus, and he went out bearing his own cross. In this case, John leaves out Simon, the Cyrene entirely, to the place called the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him with two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priest of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather, this man said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his garments and divided them into four parts, one part for each soldier. Also his tunic, but the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it shall be. This was to fulfill the scripture, which says, "They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." So the soldiers did these things. So these are the gospel accounts. The gospel accounts very clearly, all right, sometimes on the lips of Jesus himself, talk of Jesus as the man of Psalm 22, all right? Not David. Jesus is the man of Psalm 22. Now turn to Hebrews chapter 2. And so these things are about, you know, the gospel accounts are about events around 30-33 AD. Hebrews, written a number of years later, it's unclear exactly when, but most documents in the New Testament were written, you know, a couple decades or so after the crucifixion of Jesus, or even a little later. So this is sometime later, which means this Christian, whoever he was, has had time to reflect on Jesus, all right? And if you read Hebrews, you know he spent a lot of time reflecting on Jesus and has a lot to say about Jesus' role. So he's had time, in other words, to theologize, all right? When you're the disciples and you are seeing all of this unfolding, you're not theologizing. As a matter of fact, we know what the disciples did during this time. They weren't theologizing, they were fleeing, all right? But as the disciples had time to think and to pray and receive the Spirit, they had time to think about the Old Testament. And as Jesus told them, the Old Testament, you know, the Scriptures, you should read them because they talk about me. And so that's what they did. And they would read the Scriptures and they would find Jesus. And so we have now the author of Hebrews, probably a few decades later, theologizing. Let's start reading at Hebrews chapter 2, verse 5. Talking about Jesus. "For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere, 'What is man that you are mindful of him, or the Son of Man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet.'" Of course, quoting from the Old Testament. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, not Psalm 22, to be clear, "he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not see everything in subjection to him, but we see him who was for a little while made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering." All right, let's unpack that just a little bit. Going back to verse 9 there, it ends with, "so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone." This is going back to the theological point we talked about last time. Jesus as a man comes and dies as a man, all right, for humanity, because that's what it was appropriate for him to do so. Now he's going to talk about something that's also appropriate for him, what makes sense, all right, what makes sense logically, if you will. "For it is fitting," all right, it is fitting, not arbitrary, it is fitting, "that he, for whom and by whom all things exist," right, who created man? Well, God. Well, who created man? The Word, all right? God created all things through the Word. "For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering." So Jesus, all right, if Jesus is going to take the place of man, needs to experience the things of man. All right? As the fathers would say, what what the Son did not take on, he could not heal. Right? That's the notion that they had in terms of the incarnation. If Jesus was not really a man, he can't be a replacement for man in terms of his death, in terms of his substitution. And so it was fitting for him to not just live a life, but also to suffer. Verse 11. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. All right? Those who are sanctified, Christians, they all have one source. God, they all have one source, the Word. This is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers. All right? So now we've got Jesus is about to speak. All right? Jesus is about to call us brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. Psalm 22. So, when you have Jesus in the Gospels asking God, why have you forsaken me? All right? What is it? Well, you could say, you know what? He's quoting. All right? And I think we should say that. But he's also not just quoting, he was speaking in the Old Testament. And that's what the author of Hebrews says here very explicitly. Let's read it again. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers. Why the Christ is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will sing your praise. In Psalm 22, why is David doing this? David is doing this because he was at a time, right? Was David rejected by God in this psalm? No, he wasn't rejected by God. That was David feeling he was rejected by God. He knew in his mind, well, you were faithful to the fathers. He knew that in his mind. That comes out clearly in the psalm. But that's not what he was feeling. All right, he was feeling. He looked around, he's like, my mind knows you're faithful, but I look around and I look like I'm rejected. All right? Was he actually rejected? No, he was never rejected anywhere in that psalm. As a matter of fact, as you go through the psalm, you get to a point where he is actually delivered. And now, what Jesus does, or what David does, all right, there is says, oh, what am I going to do? I was delivered. Well, I'm going to proclaim the Lord's name among the brethren. Why? Because he delivered me. Right? Same here. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, deliver all those through whom, through fear of death, and subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. So as you think about the purpose of the incarnation, and as you think about the doctrine of the Trinity, as you know, we say that Jesus is both God and man. The fathers frequently had to insist, the church fathers, the early fathers, had to insist and had to fight for, all right, the idea that Jesus was a man. They had to fight for that because some people wanted to take Jesus and let's downplay the humanity part of this thing. All right? Let's downplay the humanity and just focus on the divinity. The author of Hebrews here, as you can see, is clearly not trying to de-emphasize the humanity of Jesus. It's the opposite. He's trying to say he's not just looked like a man, he had to be a man. He had to suffer all of these things so that ultimately those things in us could be cured. So now back to Psalm 22. I will tell of your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will praise you. To the author of Hebrews, that's not David. That's Jesus. The bit above the psalm. To the choir master, according to the doe of the dawn, a psalm of David. What do you think it means to be according to the doe of the dawn? Anybody? What's a doe?
Female deer.
Female deer, right? What's the doe of the dawn?
Female deer of the dawn.
A doe that you would see early in the morning. By the way, I assume things haven't changed. Any deer hunters in here? Okay. I would say yes for myself because I hunted deer in like high school. All right. Most of the deer hunters I know, unless they're going to a place where the deer are like cattle and just walking around everywhere, they will tend to deer hunt at one of two times of the day, right? Morning, early morning, or late in the evening, because that's when they'll be moving the most. The doe of the dawn, all right? Was David a hunter? David was a hunter. David was a man of the fields. Doe of the dawn. This is talking about a doe that you would see in the morning. Would this make you happy as a deer hunter? Absolutely, absolutely you would. To the doe of the dawn, Jerome, you guys remember who Jerome is? There's lots of Jeromes, actually, in history. Who is the Jerome? The Jerome is the one who translated the Latin Vulgate, all right? The big Jerome. He said this about the superscription. At daybreak on the third day, we were filled with your kindness when your son rose from the dead. In the evening, he descended for our sake into the shadows of death to draw us forth at daybreak. Accordingly, at that hour of dawn, we experienced the fullness of your kindness. It is in this sense that Psalm 22 is entitled for the doe of the dawn. Your kindness has always been manifest to your faithful servants, but never has it been so clear and lavish as when the Redeemer of all rose from the dead for the salvation for each and every one. Now, is the superscription a prophecy of the resurrection of Christ? I don't know. Jerome thought it was. But it's talking about the morning, all right? Morning, the idea of a morning, all right? Is it positive or negative? Generally speaking, it's positive, right? That's where the light's coming in and the darkness is waning. If you think about the psalm, all right, think about what happens in the psalm. It starts off as David feeling forsaken, and it ends with David on a high point, like he had just been going through the night of his life, and now dawn was actually breaking because God had not forsaken him. Actually, as he was feeling, as he knew wouldn't be right, but as he was feeling, right, dawn was coming, the doe of the dawn, God was actually watching over him. Okay, so let's break at this point. I don't want to jump into Psalm 22. Think about it for next Lord's Day. According to the book of Hebrews, all right, and according to the gospel accounts, This is Jesus speaking. So think about that and what that could mean. All right, and so we will attempt to read this psalm, not just as a psalm of David, but as a psalm of Christ. Any questions or thoughts before we dismiss? Yeah.
Yeah, in multiple places they mention wine, as you know, but they mention what seems to be two types. Wine mixed with myrrh. Mm-hmm. Or in children's books,
they only seem to mention the wine with gall, the one that Jesus actually tastes. Why is that?
It's a good question.
Do you think
they're
different wines?
Let's talk about that next time.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll begin with that. Yeah.
I just had a comment about, you said some translations take things out that are not thought to be actually accurate. And I was reading the KJV while you were reading the ESV, and there are several times when it says, according to the scriptures, or like a whole verse in the ESV has been kind of, like marked.
Removed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was really interesting. And also in the KJV, it's a unicorn and not an ox, which I liked better.
Yeah. Unicorns don't show up in the Bible. Depends on your translation. Yeah. What is a unicorn? It's an animal with one horn, quite possibly a rhino, right? Yeah. Not nearly as pretty as the white horses with a single sparkly horn, right? Okay, let's be dismissed. Next time, we'll start with talking about what you brought up. And then we'll jump into Psalm 22. Sounds good? Okay. Chip, will you pray for us, please?